Thank you for the introduction, and thank you as well for inviting me to give the seminar. So today I'm going to be talking to you about some joint work that I did with Stephen Piddock from the University of Bristol, Johannes Bast from the University of Cambridge, and Toby Kubert, who, as Michael said, is my supervisor at UCL. And the work we've been doing has been looking at the theory of Hamiltonian simulation, and in particular studying universal Hamiltonians. So throughout this talk, when I talk about Hamiltonian simulation, the type of Hamiltonian simulation we're going to be interested in is analog Hamiltonian simulation rather than digital simulation. So what we're interested in is when we want to kind of directly engineer the Hamiltonian of interest and measure its properties experimentally, rather than thinking about kind of building a fault-tolerant quantum computer and running an algorithm on that. So the obvious kind of classical example of this kind of analog simulation is building an aerofoil and studying its dynamics in a wind tunnel. And just as it's easier to kind of study a scale model of an aerofoil in a wind tunnel than it is to study the kind of dynamics of an entire aeroplane, the advantage of artificially engineering a Hamiltonian that models material of interest rather than studying the material directly is that typically it's much easier to measure and manipulate the artificially engineered system. So that's kind of the motivation for why analog Hamiltonian simulation is interesting. You know, it gives you a way to get a handle on interesting materials. And crucially, it doesn't require a full kind of fault tolerant quantum computer. So in the NISQ era, it's a kind of exciting thing to be working on. So it's been shown a couple of years ago that within a very kind of demanding definition of what it means for one Hamiltonian to simulate another, that there exists kind of very surprisingly simple models, where, you know, when I say model, I mean a family of Hamiltonians, which can simulate all other quantum many-body physics. So yeah, these kind of universal simulators were first found a couple of years ago, and trying to really understand them and, you know, can we build these in a lab? Can we understand, you know, what does universality tell us about condensed matter physics and other kind of topics of interest is something we've been working on now for a couple of years. So it's worth kind of just mentioning the kind of inspiration for this work studying universal Hamiltonians came about because there was some work done in the classical case, looking at, again, kind of simulation and universality for classical Hamiltonians. And in the classical setting, it was shown kind of in the very first paper where this, you know, where they first started thinking about simulation of classical Hamiltonians and universality. Straight away in the first paper, they completely kind of classified what Hamiltonians were universal by their complexity classes. So basically, they showed that if a classical Hamiltonian has a ground state energy problem that's NP complete, then it's also necessarily capable of simulating the complete physics of any other classical kind of spin Hamiltonian. There's a little bit of subtlety here, which is plus, so it's not just NP complete, there's two other slight conditions as well, but essentially all NP complete classical spin models are also universal. So as I said, that was in the very kind of first paper on classical Hamiltonians, they straight away got this full classification. But in the quantum case, it's been a bit more difficult, as you might expect, to get this kind of full classification. So in the first paper on universal quantum Hamiltonians, the paper kind of fully defined what it meant for one Hamiltonian to simulate another. And they found some really, really simple spin models that were universal. But there wasn't any kind of obvious link in the way that they kind of proved universality between their proof and complexity. There was some hint that there was a link between complexity and universality. So in particular, what they did was they classified all two qubit interactions by their kind of what they were universal for. So they found that the two qubit interactions, which are universal for all classical Hamiltonians, so two qubit interactions that can simulate any classical Hamiltonian, are exactly the two qubit interactions that have an entropy complete ground state energy problem. And similarly for two qubit interactions, which are universal for all stochastic Hamiltonians, they found they had a stock MA complete ground state energy problem. And two qubit interactions, which are universal for all quantum Hamiltonians, they found that they have a QMA complete ground state energy problem. But there wasn't kind of a common thread linking these classifications that allowed them to you know, determine whether there is kind of a real link between complexity and universality in the quantum case, or whether it's just a coincidence in the two-qubit case. And the more complicated structure of quantum Hamiltonians just makes it is not possible to just kind of port over the classical proof. So yeah, it was an open question whether this link existed as well in the quantum case, or whether it's just a coincidence in the two-qubit case. So what we show in this paper is that there is also a link in the quantum case. And the way we resolve this is by deriving a new method for proving universality of quantum Hamiltonians. So in all previous work looking at universal quantum Hamiltonians, the way that universality has been proved is by doing kind of long, complicated chains of perturbation gadgets. And here we completely move away from that method. So we don't use any perturbation gadgets in this work at all. And instead, we rely on the ability to encode computation into the ground states of Hamiltonians. So our main result then is that a family of Hamiltonians, M, is an efficient universal model if and only if its ground state energy problem is QMA complete under faithful reductions and the model is closed. So here, a faithful reduction, I'll talk about kind of the precise definition of faithful when we get to some kind of the technical details. But essentially, a faithful reduction, it just requires that the reduction from a promise problem to a family of Hamiltonians, it maps a subspace picked out by the rarefaction circuit to the low energy subspace of the Hamiltonian. But yeah, as I said, I'll explain what that means in more detail in the technical section of the talk. And the closure property is a bit simpler. So it just says that for any two Hamiltonians in the model H1 and H2, acting on possibly overlapping sets of qubits A and B, there exists a third Hamiltonian in the model that can simulate the sum of these two Hamiltonians. So that's our kind of our big main result. But it's also worth discussing, or just briefly mentioning, a couple of our other key results here in the introduction. So one key result is we've also provided a recipe for modifying history state Hamiltonians so that the canonical reduction from a QMA problem to the history state Hamiltonian is faithful. So typically, if we've got a QMA complete family of Hamiltonians, all we need to do to show that it's actually universal is to show closure. So although the faithful reduction is an added condition, it's not something that is typically difficult to meet. We also provide complexity theoretic classifications of universal models which aren't efficient but are still interesting. So the main theorem is about efficient universal models, and I'll explain exactly what efficiency means, but you know, as always, it means the overhead in various parameters is only polynomial. And obviously efficient universal models are very nice, but there are also some universal models which aren't efficient but are still useful. So the kind of key example is related to families of Hamiltonians that can be described succinctly. So for example, translationally invariant Hamiltonians, where the number of bits to describe the Hamiltonians much less than non-translationally invariant Hamiltonians. And we show that universality of Hamiltonians which can be described succinctly is related to QMAX completeness, which I guess is probably expected given the results around ground state energy problem for translationally invariant Hamiltonians. The second class of universal models which are not efficient but still interesting are these families of Hamiltonians where you don't you have slightly worse overhead in terms of the norm of the Hamiltonian, but you can get more precision with less with a smaller overhead in terms of the number of spins in the system. So you're trading off one parameter for another. And here we show that this family of Hamiltonian, these family of Hamiltonians are related to p-space complete universal ground state energy problems, which is maybe a slightly more surprising link. But yeah, that's what we found. We also provide a construction of two new universal models. Both of these universal models are translationally invariant systems in one dimension. So these aren't the first translationally invariant systems universal models that have been found. There is an earlier work which found a universal model on a 2D lattice, which was translationally invariant. But it is the first universal model in one dimension. But more importantly, one of these new universal models is efficient in terms of the system size overhead. This is the first universal model which is both translationally invariant and efficient in terms of the system size. And that's got a few kind of exciting applications, both in complexity theory and in building toy models of holography. It is worth mentioning it's not completely efficient, that some of its other parameters aren't efficient, but even just efficient in this one parameter already gives us some exciting applications. Cool, so those are our main results. For the rest of the talk, I'm going to give a brief overview of exactly what this kind of rigorous definition of Hamiltonian simulation is and what these previous universality results are. I'm then going to give a sketch of the proof for general conditions of universality. So I'm not going to go into any of the details of the proof, but hopefully just give you some intuition for how we got to the result and why it's interesting. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about our translation invariant, the actual kind of explicit models we've found using this new technique. And finally, I'll go to the conclusions. Okay, so what is the right mathematical definition of analog simulation? So obviously we've got some target Hamiltonian we want to simulate with some simulated Hamiltonian. So we're going to need to encode the physics of the target Hamiltonian in some subspace of the Hilbert space of the simulated system using some map. So the question is what properties we want that map to have? And in an early paper, two of my co-authors, they rigorously define exactly what properties they want this map to have by thinking operationally about what properties do we want a simulation to have. So, you know, in order for this mapping to be a simulation, it needs to preserve the energy levels, it needs to preserve the partition function, time dynamics, measurement expectation values. They came up with this long list of operational requirements, and from those requirements, what they managed to show was that any mapping of one Hamiltonian into another that preserved all these operational requirements must be of this form here, to this E of M equation here. So what we see is that in order to be a simulation, the mapping simulation is based on must, up to an isometry, just be equal to a number of copies of the Hamiltonian and a number of copies of the complex conjugate of the Hamiltonian. So P and Q here are just projectors. So this is an order for the any map of this form where V is an isometry and P and Q are projectors will preserve all the kind of physical properties of the target Hamiltonian in the simulated Hamiltonian. But we also typically will want another property, and we don't just want to preserve the physics, we want to preserve the locality of the physics. And that's because when we say preserve the locality, what I mean is we want to preserve the tensor product structure. And that's because we want local observables to be encoded locally. You know, if the whole point of doing a simulation is to make it easier to study some material of interest, we don't want to have some local observable on the target system be mapped into some huge non-local observable on the simulated system where we have to measure the whole system to get any information out about it. So this locality condition isn't necessary for the simulation to preserve physical properties, but it is necessary for it to be interesting. So these encoding maps, these are how we encode the physics of our target Hamiltonian into the physics of our simulated Hamiltonian. But these encodings kind of aren't the whole story. So we obviously in the real world, no simulation is ever going to be completely perfect. So we need to find a way to kind of add epsilons everywhere. We need to find a way to consider simulations where we allow some degree of approximation. And the difficulty with doing that is that when we allow some degree of approximation in these simulated systems in the simulation, you end up trying to compare operators acting on different spaces. And the way we get around that is by considering two mappings rather than just considering one. So what we have is this operator here, E of M, which is our local encoding, our local simulation. And then we have another operator, E tilde of M, which is we don't impose any conditions on its locality, so it doesn't have preserved tense product structure. But what we do say is that these two encodings are very close together in the sense that the isometries that define them are arbitrarily close together. So this eta parameter, we can take it to be arbitrarily small. So you can think of the local encoding as being the encoding that we have access to, we understand it. And then the non-local encoding, we might not know anything about it. We don't know how to translate it into our simulator system. We just know that it exists, and that's enough. So then the two conditions we have for a Hamiltonian H prime to be a simulation of our target Hamiltonian H is that the non-local encoding maps exactly into the low energy subspace of the target Hamiltonian. And then we have that within this subspace, so the low energy part of the target of the simulated Hamiltonian is close in operator norm to the encoding under the non-local encoding of the target Hamiltonian. You can think of the encoding we want to do, we don't quite manage to do it, but there's another coding, it doesn't quite go into the right space, so there's another coding that goes into exactly the right space, and these two encodings are close, and then the encoding that does go exactly into the right space is close to mapping to exactly the low energy Hamiltonian we have. Okay, so that's the definition of universality. And what they show in their paper is that if a mapping between Hamiltonians meets these conditions, then it approximately a bit preserves all physical quantities where, you know, we can precisely define what the error is and understand, you know, how the error changes with time. So this is a very demanding definition of what it means to simulate. You know, it's all the physical quantities are approximately simulated to within a very precisely defined error. And it's not immediately obvious that there should be any interesting examples of simulations. You know, it's quite a rigorous definition, and you might just find that it's too strong. But actually, what was found was exactly the opposite. Even within this very rigorous definition, there are Hamiltonians which are universal. Where we say that a family of Hamiltonians is universal, if any Hamiltonian you can write down, there exists a Hamiltonian in the family which can approximately simulate the Hamiltonian given. So in this first paper on universality, Cubitt, Montanaro and Piddick proved that certain very simple spin lattice models, including the 2D Heisenberg model and the 2D XY model, are universal simulators. So importantly, in this first result, they needed to allow themselves the ability to tune individual interaction strengths in the Hamiltonian in order to get this universality. But then in a later paper last year, Piddick and Bausch, they constructed the first example of translation invariant universal Hamiltonian acting on a 2D lattice. But as I mentioned in the introduction, all these previous universality results, they used perturbation gadgets. And I guess you could say they make it difficult to see the intuition between why certain Hamiltonians are universal. You know, the perturbation gadget techniques are quite convoluted. And I guess in a way they were hiding this intuition. Okay, so now I'm going to talk a bit about how our way of proving universality is different. And hopefully give you some intuition for why our new way of proving universality allows us, well, you know, shows us this link with complexity. So as I said in the introduction, our new method of proving universality, it relies on the ability to encode computation into the ground state of Kiermaier-Hard Hamiltonians. The proof of our main theorem doesn't rely at all on history states. It's completely general. For any Kiermaier-Hard Hamiltonian, it will hold. But before I kind of dive into the proof of our main theorem, I just wanted to talk a little bit about, try and give some intuition using an example of history states for what I mean by encoding computation and using that to prove a simulation result. I'm sure you all know what history states are. They're states that encode the history of a computation. Typically they're used to encode the history of a QMA verification circuit or some other complexity class verification circuit. But they don't have to be used for that. They can be used to encode the history of any computation. So in particular, one computation we could encode in them is the history of a phase estimation algorithm. Okay, and with that insight, it's kind of obvious that we can use these history state Hamiltonians to construct a Hamiltonian which is kind of semi-universal, in the sense that it recreates the energy levels of any Hamiltonian you give it. So the way we do that is using a Hamiltonian of this form here at the bottom of the slide. So here, HPE is a history state Hamiltonian that encodes the phase estimation algorithm. So just in the same way as if you had a kind of a QMA verification, if you had a history state that was encoding some QMA verification circuit, the witness in the verification circuit is the initial kind of starting point of your history state. And in the same way, if instead we're using a history state to encode the phase estimation algorithm, where we want to kind of work out the energy levels of a physical state with respect to the target Hamiltonian, then the physical state kind of takes on the role of the witness in the QMA verification version. So when I refer to the physical state of a system, that just means the state of the history state at the beginning of its computation. So what this phase estimation history state does is it encodes the computation of working out the energy levels of the physical state of the system with respect to the target Hamiltonian. And it outputs that energy in some way. So the way it outputs it is essentially arbitrary. There's lots of different ways you could choose. But what we've chosen is that the history state will output the energy by outputting a certain number of states, a certain number of qubits in a flag state A flag state, and a certain number of qubits in a B flag state, where the energy of the state with respect to the target Hamiltonian is A root 2 minus B. And essentially, you know, picking these two numbers means we can approximate any energy arbitrarily well. So what we have here is this the ground states of this phase estimation of this first term of the Hamiltonian are history states, which have as their output the energy of the physical state with respect to our target Hamiltonian. And then what these projectors do is they give just the right amount of energy to these flag states so that the energy of the history state with respect to this H universal is equal to the energy of the physical state with respect to the target Hamiltonian. Okay, so this is a fine way to reconstruct energy levels. You know, it works very well. It will, and if that's all we wanted to do in Hamiltonian simulation, we'd be done. But we don't just want to reconstruct the energy levels. We also want to reconstruct the all the measurement outcomes. This method won't work. You know, it doesn't meet all the properties to be a simulation. So one way to think about that is to see that in terms of kind of the local and the non-local properties, as they were talking about earlier, this simulation is completely non-local. Because the history states are highly entangled, you end up losing all your locality structure. But there's actually an kind of amazingly simple way to fix that and to lift this to proving full simulation. And the way we do that is before carrying out the computation, we require that the system idles in its initial state for L time steps. So then the history states, which are the kind of low energy states of this universal Hamiltonian, the history states of this form. So if we take L large enough, then with high probability, the simulated system is in the physical state, which was the starting state of this computation. So that ensures that the measurement statistics are simulated correctly. So we can also think more rigorously. So more rigorously, the local encoding and the non-local encoding are given by these two expressions down here. And it's very straightforward to show that by if we take L large enough, that this V and this V tilde are very close together, or can be made arbitrarily close together. And that meets the first condition to be an approximate simulation. Showing the other conditions are met is a bit more subtle. And that's because these projectors, which break the degeneracy of the ground state, they mean that the history states aren't themselves exactly the eigenstates of this H universal, which kind of, there's some subtlety in proving the other two conditions to be an approximate simulation. I won't go through the proof of that, it's kind of in the paper, and I don't think you need to understand it to understand kind of the intuition for why these kind of constructions work. And I should just say, you know, idling to enhance coherence, this kind of idling technique is something that's been used before in papers on adiabatic quantum computation, and also in papers on looking at kind of gap simulation. Okay, so that's kind of what I mean by our new method of proving universality, and how we use the fact that we can encode computation into ground states. So now let's move on to our...
Sorry, Tamara, can I just stop you for a second? So just to check that I'm understanding what's happening. So the local encoding is the thing you imagine you're actually going to do. And then this V tilde is something that it's like very close to, but then you can prove stuff about V tilde and how it simulates the Hamiltonian. Is that right?
Yeah. So I guess I wouldn't think of actually like doing either one in the lab, because the idea is, yeah, you want some very simple system that you can engineer, but V is the one that you imagine you know how your simple system maps on to your more complicated system via V, and because you know that, you know where you have to measure things, you know what you have to on the simulator system to understand the other system, and V tilde, you have no idea how it works, it's much more complicated, but you know it exists, and therefore you can argue about the about how good the simulation is.
Okay, so you don't do V, but it's simple enough that you kind of know how to work out what yeah, you should prepare. Yeah, okay,
exactly.
Thanks.
Okay, so now we're going to move on to talking about our actual proof of these general conditions for universality. So I'm going to talk with a little bit more detail about exactly what this faithfulness condition is. I won't go into full details. Full details are in the paper, but hopefully this will be enough to kind of get some intuition for what it means and how the proof works. So first of all, the acceptance operator of a verification circuit is defined by this expression here, where M is the number of ancillaries that we need for the circuit. Okay, so then we say that a reduction from a promise problem to the ground state energy problem of a family of Hamiltonians is faithful with respect to a particular verification circuit if for every yes instance of the problem, there exists a Hamiltonian in the model such that the low energy subspace of the Hamiltonian is close in operator norm to E of L, where L is the subspace of this acceptance operator that has small eigenvalue, and E is some local encoding. And when we say close, we mean that this value eta can be made arbitrarily small. And in the paper, we have kind of a precise expression for how eta and C all depend on exactly what our definition of low energy is. And second condition, so that's what I was speaking about in the introduction, where I kind of said the faithfulness that requires that the subspace picked out by the verification circuit is mapped to the low energy part of the Hamiltonian. This is how we define that rigorously. And then the other thing we're going to require is that the gap in the spectrum of H above S naught is related by some polynomial to the gap in the spectrum of the acceptance operator above L. So the why we have this first condition is probably quite obvious, given that you know, the intuition for why it's there is probably straightforward, given that local encodings are important for simulations. The reason we have the second condition is to do with, we want to be able to push junk energy levels up to high energy without needing to massively increase the operator norm of the Hamiltonian. So that requires that we can't have this gap closing too fast. And it's worth just saying before we kind of highlighting before we move on that this faithfulness condition, it's with respect to a particular verification circuit. So you might have a reduction that's faithful with respect to one verification circuit that won't necessarily be faithful with respect to another verification circuit. And when we say that a family of Hamiltonians is QMA complete under faithful reductions, what we mean is that for any problem in QMA, and for any polynomial no-mill time verification circuit for that problem, there exists a faithful reduction with respect to that circuit. So you know, the reductions might be different for different circuits, but for any circuit there is a faithful reduction. Okay, so that's all I'm going to say about the faithfulness condition. And the closure condition, as I said in the introduction, is much more straightforward. It just means that for Hamiltonians in the model, sums of Hamiltonians within the model can be simulated by another Hamiltonian also within the model. Okay, so those are our conditions. How do we prove that they're necessary and sufficient for universality? So the necessary direction is fairly straightforward. Closure is just obviously necessary by the definition of universality. For any Hamiltonian we can write down must be simulated by a Hamiltonian within the model, and that includes sums of Hamiltonians also within the model. The second condition is a little bit more detailed to show that it's necessary, but essentially what we do is that we construct a family of Hamiltonians which are QMA complete under faithful reductions, and we use the fact that any Hamiltonian which can simulate that family must itself be QMA complete under faithful reductions. So the family of Hamiltonians we use is a small penalty version of the Kitaev history state. So the small penalty just gives us the second condition here. By having a smaller penalty in the history state construction, we're able to make sure that we keep the gap small. And the faithful reductions are just the normal reductions you use to show QMA completeness of history states, but you add idling to enhance coherence in order to make sure we get that there's a local encoding between the subspace picked out by the circuit and the low energy state of the Hamiltonian. And I won't go into any details of the proof, but it's just via the perturbation theory. Okay, so that's the necessary direction. What about the sufficient direction? Well, to prove that these conditions are sufficient for universality, we consider some family of Hamiltonians, which we know nothing about except that they satisfy these conditions, and show that there is for any target Hamiltonian we want to write down, we can always find a Hamiltonian within the model that simulates that target Hamiltonian. In order to do that, I need to introduce a completely trivial and probably very strange sounding problem, which we refer to as yes Hamiltonian. So the input to this Hamiltonian is just some the input to this problem is just some k-local Hamiltonian H, and the output is always yes. So obviously this problem is completely trivial. It's clearly in QMA because it's in P. I mean, it's completely trivial. But just because it's a trivial problem doesn't mean we have to choose a trivial verification circuit for it. So if you remember the definition of QMA complete under faithful reductions, it says that for any problem in QMA and any polynomial time verification circuit, there must be a faithful reduction. So what we're going to do is we're going to take this completely trivial problem and choose a non-trivial verification circuit for it that maps out an interesting subspace. So that subspace is given in this expression here. So the the kind of the witness states in the subspace are split into two registers. The first register contains some eigenstate of the target Hamiltonian H, and the second register, with some probability, contains just a blank state, and with some probability contains a description of the energy of this state, of the eigenstate with respect to the target Hamiltonian. And A here is some constant that we can take to be as large as we like. Okay, so why is the subspace useful? Okay, so first of all, how do we show that this we can construct a polynomial circuit which acts as a verification circuit for this problem. So I'm going a little bit low on time, so I won't go through this in detail, but essentially we have some ancillas, registers B and B prime, where B prime is just one qubit, and the B register is the same size as this A prime register. We apply unitary rotation onto the B prime register, and then controlled on the B prime register, we use phase estimation on this input state with respect to the unitary directed by our target Hamiltonian, and we use it to estimate this energy E mu, and then we just do a swap test between the registers A prime and B. And what we show in the paper is that this procedure is polynomial time, and also it accepts with probability one on states in this subspace W, and on all other states it has acceptance probability lower than one. Okay, so by the faithfulness condition, for any target Hamiltonian that we might want to simulate, there exists a Hamiltonian within our family of Hamiltonians M, such that the low energy subspace is close to a local encoding acting on this witness subspace. And using this, along with the closure property, we can show that this Hamiltonian H sim is a simulation of this Hamiltonian H prime. So I'm going to talk through H sim a little bit, hopefully explain exactly what's going on. So what we have here is HS, the low energy, parts of HS, you can think of them as being the states in this subspace W. In fact, they're not exactly those states, but they're related to those states by local encoding. And then the high energy, anything that picks up high energy from HS, we multiply it by some large parameter delta. So those are just junk energy levels which we push up to high energy and aren't included in the simulation. Then the second term here. These are like the flag states in the history state version I was talking about. So essentially, giving a penalty to a state is clearly something we can do with a Hamiltonian. So in the paper, we construct we show that the act of just giving an energy one to a qubit is something that we can clearly simulate within this model. So what we have here, HSIM, is a sum of terms in the model, and in exactly the same way that we showed that the history state Hamiltonian is a simulation, this is a simulation for exactly the same reason. So again, showing the second two conditions a little bit subtle, it needs some kind of extra work, but showing that this Hamiltonian is close and norm to the target Hamiltonian is very straightforward, and the other conditions are basically just algebra. Okay, so this Hamiltonian H sim is a simulation of H prime. By the closure property, there exists a Hamiltonian in M which simulates H sim. Now H prime isn't itself the Hamiltonian we want to simulate, but what we do in the paper is we explicitly construct encoding to show that H prime simulates H. And it's very straightforward to do this. That's basically why we need to have this A with the blank symbol in our witness state. Because then by taking A large, we can make this witness state very, very close to just the eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. And that's how we, using the fact that this is close to the eigenstate, then we can say that our local encoding is just the identity, and the non-local encoding is just a direct isometry between the two subspaces. And then we just use the fact that simulations compose to show that this therefore proves that H-sim is itself a simulation of H. And therefore, we've shown that we know nothing about the family of Hamiltonians M, except that it obeys the two conditions. And using that, we've shown that for any arbitrary target Hamiltonian I want to write down, I can find this Hamiltonian within M, which simulates the target Hamiltonian. Okay, so that's just, a rough sketch of the proof for general conditions for universality, but hopefully it gives you some intuition for kind of why the result is true if it doesn't go through the details. So I'm going to talk just very briefly about a sketch of the proof for translation invariant universal models in one dimension. So not really a sketch of a proof, more just a discussion of what the models are and what's nice about them. So one thing which I didn't mention before, but that is worth touching on, is how do we encode a description of the target Hamiltonian simulated system? So, if this is our universal Hamiltonian, do we need a different history state Hamiltonian for every Hamiltonian we want to simulate? Because it wouldn't be a great universal model if all that they have in common is that they're history states. We want there to be some, them to all have some common characteristics. We want them to really be a family of Hamiltonians that can be understood together. And the answer is no, we don't need a different history state Hamiltonian for every Hamiltonian we want to simulate. So what we do instead is we encode a description of the target Hamiltonian into a property of the simulated system. And the computation then extracts this information prior to carrying out the phase estimation algorithm. And the phase estimation algorithm takes this property as its input. So in abstract, that probably doesn't make very much sense. So we'll go through a couple of examples. So the first example is this idea from Gottesman and Irani's paper on translation invariant ground state energy problem. And the idea is that we can encode the description of the target Hamiltonian into the binary expansion of the length of the simulated spin chain. Then before we do our phase estimation to work out the energy of the work out the energy levels of our target Hamiltonian, we first do a binary counter-Turing machine. So the binary counter-Turing machine, it calculates N and it outputs N written in binary as the output of that computation. And the phase estimation then takes this as its input and carries out phase estimation with respect to this description of H target. So what's nice about this universal model is that the only thing you need to vary is the length of the simulated spin chain. And you can show just by changing the length of the spin chain, all the interactions are fixed. Some of the, the delta and T vary, but those are the only things you vary. And just varying that, you can encode all quantum physics into this very simple model. The downside of this this universal model is that the size of the system, so the number of spins in the simulated system, is exponential in the number of spins on the target system. And that's kind of inevitable if the only thing we're allowing ourselves to vary is the size, because just by simple counting arguments. So our second universal model is slightly different. So what we do in this model is, instead of encoding the description of the Hamiltonian into the length of the spin chain, we encode it into the binary expansion of a phase in the Hamiltonian. And the computation carried out by the history state is just phase estimation twice. First, it does phase estimation on this parameter in the Hamiltonian using a construction in this paper by Qubit, Perez, Garcia, and Wolf. And again, this is a Turing machine construction, so it does phase estimation on this parameter in the Hamiltonian, and it writes out the answer, which is a description of H target on its tape. And then the second phase estimation again takes this as input, calculates the energy of the physical state with respect to this, and then the simulation carries on in the way we've been discussing. So as I said, what's nice about this model is that it's efficient in terms of its system size overhead. And using the fact that it's translation invariant and efficient allows us to derive some new results in terms of complexity theory, and also we've used it for some examples in holography. So yeah, that was all I wanted to say. So thank you for your time. The main points are just we've developed a new method to prove universality and used it to drive a rigorous connection between complexity and universality. We've also used it to demonstrate universality of two new models, including the first translation invariant model, which is efficient in terms of system size overhead. And just one last question is, can we use these techniques to develop physically realizable simulators? So previously, the block on universal models being physically realizable was, you really needed to fine tune these parameters in the Hamiltonian. And with these translation invariant models, you don't have to do that anymore. But the flip side is their local state dimension is absolutely huge. But there are some techniques known to bring that down. So that's something we will be looking at in the future. Thank you for your time.
Great. Let's all thank Tamara for a really interesting talk. I can open up for questions. Maybe I'll start. So I have a question maybe on your last point here. So you said the model you construct, this 1D translation invariant model, is efficient in terms of the number of kind of particles you need, but then you said it was not efficient in terms of other parameters, but maybe I didn't catch exactly what those were.
Oh yeah, so the main one is just the norm of the norm of the Hamiltonian. Okay. It's to do with the length of time the computation runs for, but essentially this kind of delta parameter that you have to multiply. This delta parameter that you have to multiply this by, it really blows up. So it's exponential in terms of system size. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's not efficient. And that's why, if they had been completely efficient, we would have, broken complexity theory by showing that we could simulate non-translation invariant things efficiently with translation invariant things. So yeah, it's good that it wasn't. That's not actually the barrier to building it in the lab. The barrier to building it in the lab is the local state dimension. And that's not something that's included in the definition of efficiency. And even if it was, it's fixed. It's very big, but it's fixed. It doesn't vary with the size of the system.
Is that something you tried to optimize down, or did you not?
No, we didn't try at all. Okay. So there was a paper. So I think the original kind of Gottesman and Irani translation invariant QMAX complete construction had a local dimension of 10 to the 6. Mm-hmm. And our construction is kind of based on theirs. So, it'd probably be a bit bigger, but roughly there. And there was a paper a few years later which brought that down to, I think, 10 to the 30 or something. Not 10 to the 30, just 30. So it brought it down by 6 orders of magnitude by using different computational techniques. So we think something similar would work here, but we haven't actually thought about it in detail yet.
Okay. Cool. And so kind of carrying on this theme, I actually saw another talk about this kind of very topic the other day. And it's this paper you probably know by Leo Zhu and Daria Haranov, and they're talking about, they construct some kind of Hamiltonian simulation which is I think efficient in both the particle number and this energy, but then from what you were saying there seems to be some reasons why, is it, so it would be possible, but is it just impossible to do this in 1D?
I think their one isn't translation invariant.
Oh, okay.
Because I've read the paper. So I think what they have is they have the same type of interaction at each phase, mm-hmm. but you're allowed to vary the strength of the interaction at each point along on the lattice.
And this is like you, this is necessary if you want to get this efficiency. You wouldn't be able to do it. There's no way otherwise.
I think so, just because otherwise you'd end up proving that QMAX was equal to QMA, which I mean would be a big result. But probably unlikely.
Great, thanks. Do you have any more questions?
I have a quick one. You just so it's the local Hilbert space dimension you were saying here is probably like also high.
Yeah, very big.
You said it was like 10 to the 6 or something?
Yeah.
So what could you, do you remember what the techniques are or how, like what was, what were you describing to get it down to 30?
Yeah, I mean, it's in a lot of paper I've actually read, but so the the way we encode computation is a quantum Turing machine. And it's kind of, not optimized for embedding things in Hamiltonians. So they basically come up with a whole new model of computation because the circuit model is difficult to make a translation invariant. But the Turing machine model leads to a huge blow up in Hilbert space dimension. So yeah, they come up with a completely new model of computation in order to optimize for translation invariance as well as Hilbert space dimension.
And you think techniques like that could be applied to your setup to optimize?
Yeah, and I mean, what they use to show it is, they use it to show that this translation invariant system is QMAX complete. So by our result, therefore that system is also a universal simulator. So it's almost immediate, but that immediate construction, it probably isn't the simplest way of doing it because showing closure, and it might be more straightforward just to do something similar to what we did in here and actually construct the model.
Interesting, yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
So I had one question. What was the need for idling again? You mentioned something about reducing the non-locality, but couldn't you not use like the 5 local clock construction? Can you just explain that part again? Maybe?
Yeah, so sorry, yeah, locality, I guess, in a slightly different sense of the word. So if you don't have any idling, then the physical state is encoded into history state is very non-local because history state is very, very highly entangled. So if we had some measurement operator we wanted to do on the history state, even if it was just a local operation on the physical state, on the simulated system, it would be some huge non-local operation acting everywhere. But by doing idling with very, very high probability, the state is in its physical state. Because that's the initial state of the computation. So the map from the physical state to the simulator is close to being trivial, which means that the map between the physical state and the simulator state, it preserves the locality of the it preserves the kind of tensor product structure of the physical state. So when I say locality, I'm really meaning the tensor product structure of the physical state, rather than the locality of the terms in the history state Hamiltonian. Too many uses of the word locality.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, I was confused about that part. Thank you.
No worries. Thank you.
Do we have any further questions? Okay, if not, let's thank Tamara again for a really great talk.
And thank you for coming.